For the benefit of those who have not been present during the whole of this encounter, I want to summarize some of the things that have happened as a lead-in, as a kind of bridge to what the bishop is going to say to us tonight. He told us earlier in the day that there are different ways of crossing a stream besides a bridge, that you can swim or you can go in a boat. And some of you will
thought many things in the
way, but I'm going to use the time I have. It seems to me best. I hope you will be satisfied. We arrived 3 days ago for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. I'm sure this is something that we will never forget, and something which I, coming from England, where perhaps we are more hide-bound in our traditions, never imagined would be possible. 5 years ago, I had the privilege of an audience with the Pope in Rome, in St. Peter's. And since then, I've had a tremendous feeling of love and affection for our Roman Catholic friends, and had encounters with them, but never anything like this. A thing that has been of great interest is the fact that some of the Roman Catholic sisters no longer wear their habits. This has been a refreshing discovery, and we have made some very good friends, I believe, between the denominations, and I think it has made it easier in some ways for some of us that there were no habits. I know this is a moot point. On Saturday, not Saturday, what day? Wednesday. I wrote Saturday, but I meant Wednesday. On Wednesday, we began in this lovely hall with an experience which was called an invocation. And on the screen, we saw some beautiful pictures. And at the same time, there was a spoken commentary, a meditation. The pictures were very varied. They showed us human need and God's wonderful creation. And it really was an act of worship. And I'm sure we'd like to thank those who were responsible for the invocation. Then we heard a talk, a lecture, by a Roman Catholic who is on the staff of a Methodist theological seminary. Surely that is unique as well. The Reverend George Tavard spoke to us about the feminine principle in recent Catholic tradition. It was a very thought-provoking and interesting address, and the question period that followed showed the tremendous lot of interest and a certain amount of hostility, I think. This was taken in very good part by the lecturer. On Thursday, in the morning, we had a talk from Mrs. Cynthia Widell. I keep wanting to use the word unique because there are so many unique things about this conference. And Mrs. Widell is unique because she is the first woman to be elected as the president of the National Council of Churches. And she talked to us about human and woman and the need to get away from the sexual connotations about God. And she told us, reminded us of the amusing story of the astronaut who, when he returned to Earth, was asked whether he had seen God and what he was like. And his reply was, "She's black." Mrs. Widell says that this is an age of revolution, that is, of change, of turning things round. And we're all very conscious of this. She spoke about the deep-seated feelings of inferiority in women, but that intelligence tests, when they were first begun, revealed that there is no basic inferiority due to sex, and this was a surprise to many people. And her emphasis was that it is possible to be different without inequality. We had a service in the chapel following this, an ecumenical worship service for church unity. And the beauty of the chapel makes it very easy to worship. After the service was over, we saw an abstract interpretation through Duns of the parables, and it was an interesting study to try to decide which parables were being represented. To many of us, this was a new art form, and I found it very interesting indeed. In the afternoon, the Reverend John Tejon, who is the president of Concordia Lutheran Seminary, talked to us about free to serve. And he used the words of Luther a good deal, as we would expect, talking about freedom from bondage, which is the basic New Testament theme. And he commented at the end that we do not find life by grasping it, but by giving it away. Group discussion followed later, and the groups no doubt were very interesting because some of the questions that came out of them were discussed in a panel dialogue in the evening. The panel consisted of Mrs. Widell, Father Tavard, Dr. Tejon, Sister Martin de Porres, is that the right way to say that? Dr. Catherine Gonzalez and Deaconess Gladys Noreen. And they dealt very effectively with the questions raised by the groups. Today, I'm still tempted to use the word unique because we had a talk from a rabbi, the Rabbi Samuel Sandmill from Cincinnati, who talked on the subject covenant, contract, and two parties involved. And he spoke about Israel's covenant relationship with Yahweh and pointed out that the background of the Old Testament is that of a masculine civilization, which is carried forward into the New Testament, particularly in the writings of St. Paul, the very controversial remarks that he makes in his first letter to the Corinthians about women keeping silence in church. And the rabbi told us that next June, a student, whom he called Sally, is to be ordained, or whatever the Jewish equivalent is, as a rabbi. And that also will be a first. And she's already proving very acceptable to her congregation, he said. And next, one of the highlights of this whole time together, the concelebrated Mass for Christian Unity, in which we shared this morning with a tremendous sense of privilege. It really was an unforgettable experience, as together we received the body and blood of Christ. There was a sense of God's presence. And of course, to many of us, parts of the service were very familiar. Indeed, there were some differences, but much was familiar. And we do say a very big thank you to our Roman Catholic friends for giving us that experience. Then we heard a talk by Bishop James K. Matthews of Boston, whom we're to hear again in a few minutes, on the subject, New Woman, Identity. He said that woman's search for identity has made men unsure of their role. I'm not going to venture to give Bishop Matthews talk again, because we'll be hearing him continuing this subject in a few minutes, but I noted down some of the things that were of special interest, I thought. A reminder that, before all else, women are human beings. But that does need to be said sometimes. That God's will is the new creation, that we should be God's persons, so fulfilling the will of our Creator. It has been a wonderfully enriching experience for us all. And now, Bishop Matthews.
Thank you, Sister Blanche. I feel as if I've been here throughout, even though I know I haven't been. This was a very excellent summary. I want to address you as fellow ministers of Jesus Christ, that is everyone here, whether you are an ordained minister or a lay person, for we are all ministers of Jesus Christ. And I want to say to you this Christian greeting, reminding you that grace is yours and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, I was pleased to be able to talk to a few at any rate informally. They have a procedure in Africa. We would call it parliamentary procedure. Ours is very formal in this country, of course, and in throughout the Western world. And I recall an African rebuked this in a setting where this was being pursued pretty carefully. And he said, "We are freer in Africa. Everybody is allowed to express himself. And then, although we may not accept the position stated, we simply say, you have been heard." So I was pleased to hear from some of you in informal conversation, and I'm glad to have another chance at bat. I do want to say this, lest I should not find another context in which I could say it, that I believe that we are living today in one of the great days of the Christian church. I know that not everyone will agree with this, but it seems to me that the church historians of the future will be saying exactly that. We sometimes get it into our heads that we are in the eddies alongside the stream. Rather, it seems to me we're in midstream, and I repeat, in some of the great days of the church. I'm sure of this, that all of the great days in the past have been painful ones, and that would be true of our time as well. Now, I began this afternoon by citing Quincy Howe, who says that humanity nowadays is on trial for its life. That is undoubtedly true, and I would rejoice in this, for it seems to me that it is also God's intention that all people should come to their full personhood and maturity. So these two things, the threat and the promise, seem to meet at this particular point. So we have given some attention to the new woman with regard to identity. The approach is not a theoretical one. The new woman who is emerging is conscious of having cast off an old image. The new role is not one which we define, for that is the old process, the old way. But the new woman is committed to being who she is, so honoring her Creator. And then, being who she is, qualities emerge which can be described. So we don't define, we merely describe. Perhaps it's a little premature to do that. And so we're in something of a dilemma. In speaking of the feminine revolution, we said it was a part of the cultural revolution of our day, that we may see about it a burst of awareness in which the question of identity is raised, which is the human question that all people finally must ask: how may I be a human being? This moves into a struggle for equality. And there is a price which must be paid in this struggle, a risking of all, even our femininity, if that's what we have. And the reward is the emergence of the new woman, and I should say, not a moment too soon. Now, there's been a good deal of stress on liberation, but that's not the end, for this affects all mankind, all humankind, all men and all women as well. Now, if we take the flip side, as it were, of this freedom, we find there waiting for us solemn responsibility. When we thrust ourselves into history, we find we have the world on our hands. And the new woman finds this both an awesome burden and a mighty challenge. Now, this calls, it seems to me, for a solidarity among womanhood, which is lacking at the present time. In Ghana, they have a wonderful proverb, which when men hear, they translate this way: all men, all women are alike. Now, that's familiar enough. But a woman hearing that translates the same words in a different way. All women are one. Well, let us hope that they will find that solidarity. For the new woman demands a new lifestyle. We run into this designation lifestyle everywhere we turn today. It has to do with image, with symbol, with mode, with mood. It is reflected in music and dance and art forms of other types. It is found in banners such as we have around this hall. I must say this, that the banners of the churches are flying today. And one of my good Christian friends, a lady has a banner in her home. And this banner tells a good deal about her. For it has this caption on it. When you pick up a handful of dirt, and it's dirt, that's one thing. But if it's not dirt, but mystery, then you are a part of the circus of life. Well, I think that's simply marvelous, and it shows which side she's on nearly any issue you could mention at the present time. And then lifestyle shows up in everyday living, as it should. Now, historically speaking, the Christian lifestyle has frequently been quite clear. At one time, it was the image of the soldier. Another time of the martyr, another time of the monk, another perhaps the pilgrim. But what is the Christian lifestyle today? Well, the perplexing matter is that I suppose no one of us is prepared to say exactly what it should be. This new lifestyle suggests that that a new mythology must be embraced, for the old ones have a way of collapsing. If we go back into ancient history, we find among the Phoenicians about 3000 B.C. that they had the goddess Astarte. And several of her captions were the following. She was the heavenly cow, the seed producer, the opener of the womb. The image there was of childbearer, and this has, of course, persisted. And there is another mythological form, the earth mother, who again produces and nurtures and suckers and recreates. Then, of course, there is the Virgin Mary, mother of God and mother of all. She creates, as it were, from nothing. Not only as mother of all is she comprehensive, but she is futuric in that she creates that which is to be. She is also the image of intentionality. She is committed. My soul magnifies the Lord and the rest. Or she can be considered an ideal of womanhood, and frequently this has been corrupted, and she's become woman on a pedestal. And yet for us Protestants, we have a great deal to learn at this particular point, for we seem to be utterly lacking in appropriate symbols of the female principle. And we should take heart that in Mexico again and again, not under the red banner, but of the blue banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe, the peasants have gone forth in revolution. Or we could think of this image, this symbol, the first Eve. She is of the past, but she relates to all the universe. Her initiative was such that she took the risk to share in the creative action of God. And so we might say that every woman could take the image, the symbol of the second Eve, who takes the risk of a new future for all mankind. Now, the Christian tradition is not the only one, of course, in which there are mythological symbols of these kinds, but they are in the contemporary non-Christian religions as well. I think, for example, of the city of Calcutta, which I think has at times vied with Santiago, Chile, and Kobe in Japan for the dubious honor of having the worst slums on earth. I think perhaps nowadays, unmistakably, Calcutta has that lot. But in Calcutta, there is a temple to the goddess Kali, who is the goddess destruction, one of the less pleasing aspects of deity in Hinduism. And Kali Ghat, the temple of Kali, is the very place from which the city of Calcutta gets its name. It is there that one finds one of the few places in India today where sacrifice of animals is taking place. A little like, I suppose, it took place in the temple of Jerusalem of old. And yet next door to this temple to Kali, there is a remarkable institution. It is a place where there is gathered together the dying and the destitute. Anyone who has no one else to care for him or for her is taken there. And this is the institution established by Mother Teresa. And not far away, there is a hospital where the destitutes, as it were, at the other end of the line. The babies taken literally out of garbage cans are brought together. Now, here we have, it seems to me, an appropriate new symbol for our day, so that all the children of the world are her children, and all of mankind are a part of her responsibility. Would that we could embrace such a vision as is so clearly evidenced there on the part of Mother Teresa and those, the missionaries to the poor associated with her. Now, I mentioned a while ago this burden of freedom and responsibility. If we try to ground that, we find this, that freedom is not an abstraction. It is not just freedom from male domination in this context, but it is freedom for and in behalf of the whole world. And the assumption of this burden and the price paid for that is the price we must pay, or women must pay, for their new womanhood. And then she must forge a new image of femininity. Now, this is not a role, but a reality. This is implicit in being. It's not so much an interplay in contrast between male and female as a polar relationship between masculinity and femininity. And we have this polarity not only among us and between us, but within us all. Now, sometimes we define the masculine role as that of the adventurer, and the feminine role is that of the ability to receive. It is not so much a matter of dress or appearance or externality, but it is a quality of life. It is not merely a sociological and a psychological matter, but it is a matter of our real being. One could almost feel then the interplay of this polarity and the mystery that surrounds it all, the giving of self and withholding of self, the creator and the conserver, the saving and the spending, the enabler and the restrainer, the intuitional and the rational, the quietness, that pole and that of passion. The East surely had something in this concept of yang and yin and their interplay, so that we can say that men release the creative power of women, and I do not mean this in merely the aspect of physical generation, but rather the very presence of man and woman, or masculinity and femininity, releases a kind of mutual creativity of every kind. Likewise, as every poet has known and sung, women inspire men. This new woman engages, having cast a new image of femininity, engages alongside the male in the bending of all history. Now, this is partly a matter, I think, of self-confidence, which is always precarious. I was reading only the other day the story of the spies of Israel going into the Promised Land, and you know they brought back contradictory reports. And they were so overwhelmed by what they saw there that they felt themselves to be grasshoppers, and they wanted to turn to make a captain and turn back toward Egypt. Well, in that experience and in self-depreciation at any time, there is involved self-destruction, which finally destroys all it meets. But on the other hand, authentic womanhood can release man into his authentic manhood. There's power here if it is shared. It's a great deal like the Black Revolution to which I made reference this afternoon. I am sure every person who is white here must have at some time in recent years experienced this. When he is truly confronted by a black person in his or her blackness, then we are aware of our whiteness. That is, of course, obvious. But if we are confronted by a black person who is not faithful to his or her blackness, then, of course, nothing really happens. But when we see authenticity on the part of a black person, then it summons forth authenticity with us. When we are presented with a real black person, then the possibility of being a real person ourselves is present to us. With something very like that, I mean, when I refer to the fact that when an authentic woman stands before a man, the possibility of his manhood is experienced all over again. If he treats woman like a thing, he experiences a kind of thinghood himself. He too is caught in a kind of treadmill. And so it is possible when women are true to their femininity that a new definition of masculinity is also possible. And they proceed together into the future. Recently, I read a part of a poem by Jose Villa, and he uses a striking metaphor, which I think is appropriate at this time. He speaks of remembering the future. And so our whole direction is turned around from being bound by the past until we're propelled, as it were, into the future. And this new woman implies a new family dynamic. Freed from idolatry of home and self-bondage, she may engage in other dimensions of life. I think it would be fair to say that family life in this country or throughout the West is very near collapse today. I was present for a discussion of this subject some time ago, and they wanted to have a kind of a conversation piece in the middle of the room where this was being discussed, and of all things, they built there a house of cards. Nothing else had to be said. But the breakdown of the family, as we've known it in recent generations at any rate, is a very real threat and possibility to us. I think any one of us can fill in the gaps there. And I do not want to pause here very long, except to observe, as I've already implied, that our present idea of the family, the nuclear family, is a rather relatively new one. In contrast to that is the extended family. When I first went to India, I was somewhat surprised to find what they called there the Hindu undivided family. That is, under one roof of a fairly large establishment, the father and mother, and then the sons and their wives and their children learn. Sometimes you'll have as many as 100 people, all a part of this Hindu undivided family. They even have income tax, which spreads in a unitary sense for that whole group. And I talked to a member of such a family one time, and I said, what is your political preference? And he says, well, I have none. My brother has the politics for the family, and we vote as he tells us to do. Well, now, this was very surprising to me, because I had come out of a nuclear family, and yet, when I was finally confronted with an extended family, I recalled, just could barely recall, that I knew a little about that as I reached back in my own experience, too. For it isn't so long ago in this country that we had something very like extended families ourselves. We used to attend family reunions, I suppose. We used to know who our cousins were, our first cousins, our second cousins, and if we lived down south as far as Georgia, we even knew our fourth cousins. And I recall that in the town where I grew up as a small boy, there were other relatives there, aunts and uncles. And I had a task when I was ever so small of carrying starter. Now, how many know what starter is? Well, that dates you. Well, but for the uninitiated, starter is something like yeast. I never really did get into the intricacies of it. But you took a mason quart jar, and I would take it from our house to my aunt's house about a half a mile away, and she would start the bread with this starter, and you'd feed it with potatoes, I believe, feed the yeast, and then a day or two later, I'd have to go to my aunt's house and carry it back to my mother. That was a part of the role of an undivided family, an extended family in our culture, and I'm glad I can just remember it. And there was something else. These aunts and uncles and grandparents, if they were living, had a very real role if they were within reach. In our highly mobile society, they usually are not. Now, we have such small houses, generally speaking, today, that they couldn't live with us even if we thought it was desirable. And we've been taught to think that that was not desirable. And we've quietly got the older, retired people out of the way, out of sight and out of mind. We, United Methodists, have a way of calling such places Wesley Acres and things like that. But we've paid a fearful price for this. For when these relatives, a part of our extended families, lived with us or in close proximity to us, they played a great role, and we hardly noticed it when that role was no longer available to us, and yet we've already paid the price for it. For these aunts and uncles and all the rest were engaged very frequently in the moral and spiritual instruction of children. Any parent knows that although he may think of himself as the moral and spiritual director of his children, he's usually not very successful at it. And it is usually someone removed a bit who is able to fulfill this. I noticed that when our grandparents come to the house, they immediately fall into this role and are able to speak to our children in a way that we, their parents, cannot possibly do. Well, you see, then here we have to move back and recover something of that. We cannot really go back. We must go forward in order to get back to something very like that. Here, the extended family was a context for vision of life. It was a context for mission, for there is such a thing as a family mission. It was a place where there was assigned participation in the works and demands of society. And some of the great families in any nation have known that very well. You just think of the Adams family, for example. They knew that to be an Adams, they had to engage in the political dimension of society. Or think of this wonderful Kennedy family that assigned members to great political roles in this country, determining long before it was anything but a vision that one of the sons should be president of the United States. And when the first one was removed, lost in World War I, then number two came up, and then number three, and now number four. Now, these things do not happen, but there's something absolutely marvelous about this. And within this context, there was accountability. There was also absolution. We had a wayward brother-in-law by the name of Eddie. He was quite wayward. And yet when he came into the bosom of the family, he was accepted. He may have been wayward, but he was our wayward Eddie. And he had a context of acceptance finally. And here there was a preparation for responsibility. And as Toffler calls it, the family could be a great shock absorber, so that in a small way, children could experience in a larger context than father and mother the shocks that a fuller life would greet them with in the days ahead. So it is possible that the new woman has a fundamental role in a new pluralistic image of the family. She can, of course, ignore the children. She can kill possibility in the lives of those about us. She can run, or she can wait, or she can dream, or she can recover and help to reformulate something of what Margaret Mead has called the cluster family. I happen to know near one of our great cities, a group of some dozen couples there in their 30s and 40s who have deliberately established such a cluster. They lived all about this great city, but in planning together, they decided to move into one particular suburb. And so they have simply infiltrated that larger community. They knew that they lived in a global situation, so they took a trip around the world together to see some of the significant other cities of our urban world. And because some members of this group had lower incomes than the others, they shared proportionally in the cost of such a trip as that and in other economic ventures of their new cluster. And not only that, but to prepare their children for such a world as this, they are educating their children at the secondary level all over the world in a dozen different countries. Well, it takes boldness to do that. And here is great room for experimentation. Now, almost nobody knows me, but everybody knows my brother Joe in Chicago. If you reacted, you know him. But at any rate, he started out in a small way here in the Christian Faith and Life community in Austin, Texas, moved to the Ecumenical Institute in Chicago. They offered him a job there, I think, for $7,000 a year, and he said, I'll come if I can bring 8 other people with me. And they said, oh, we have salary only for one. He said, they'll work for $1 a year. And so he transported them all to Chicago. There they've grown to a community of 700 people, living a corporate life in the weekends, returning to their nuclear families, as it were, but the rest of the week as an extended family, as an ecumenical order, if you will, and now have spread to 36 other countries on the North American continent and some 30 countries in other parts of the world. They've taken seriously this model. And so in this experimentation is not only not inconsistent with the Christian faith, it would seem to be an implementation of the Christian faith. And so life together is now required of us. And I plead with those of you who are in Roman Catholic orders, don't give up the ship. We never needed you more than we do at the present time. And I was so delighted to meet a Sister Angèle from New Orleans. Some of you may know her. And she's taken a vow to do what she can for the recovery of the orders within the Roman Catholic Church. For the old nuclear system had a way of causing the family to turn in on itself and being the particular vehicle for perpetuating the stereotypes of womanhood and manhood extant today in our country. But the new order may cause us to turn out and live for the sake of all of society. I think women are the key to this situation. The new woman, let us not for a moment forget Mother Teresa. And then this can only be sustained by what can be called covenantal relations and based on dynamic structures. I refer here to the intentional nature of marriage and of other vocational commitments. For marriage is not based on sentimentality or on bourgeois love, but rather on promise. Now, I do not always feel loving toward my wife, but I'm bound by promise to her. A year ago last summer, on the 1st of June in 1970, I happened to be away from home, which is the story of my life, and I went up to Nainital in the Himalayas. And there I made my way to a school. It was once a Christian school. It's now a Hindu school. And then I said in my somewhat feeble Hindustani, could they direct me to the chapel? And they did. And I went to the chapel, which had now become a classroom. And I went to where the altar had been and still for me was. And there in the presence of the Hindu servants running, caring for the building, I knelt in prayer. Now, you don't have to apologize about prayer in India. It's one of the things that is expected of you if you are a religious person. Well, the room was filled with perhaps a half a dozen other people when I knelt to pray. And when I got up, I discovered they'd all slipped quietly outside, which was a nice gesture on their part. And when I went out, they were all looking a question at me. And then I explained that 30 years before that day, my marriage had taken place there. And if my wife could not be with me on that anniversary occasion, at least I could be there. Now, I mention that simply to reinforce the fact that I am not always lovingly disposed toward my wife, but I am bound by promises made to her on June 1st, 1940, in the presence of God and of his people. And likewise, together with you, I'm sometimes disheartened and disillusioned with regard to the church. But then I know this, that on a June day in New York City in 1936, I knelt at an altar, and Bishop O'Connell laid hands on my head and ordained me a deacon in the Church of God. Now, not in the Methodist Church, but in the whole Church of God. And then 2 years later, in Pune, in India, I knelt at another altar, and Bishop Badley and other ministers of the church laid hands on my head, and I was made an elder, a presbyter, a priest of the whole Church of God. And when I'm disillusioned with the church, and when I'm disheartened, I am not bound by a sentimental attitude, but I am bound by vocation to the church once again. This was done in the presence of the church. So marriage is a part of the church, of the whole church, of the local church. It encourages and undergirds a mutuality. The roles in marriage may change. There may be an interplay, a new dynamic running through the institution, and yet this abides, and the church sustains it. I've been an absentee father most of my life. That means that my wife has had to be father and mother a great deal of the time. But I'm not entirely insensitive to the situation. I saw to this, that once in the lifetime, my three children in turn have gone with me on some extended tour in some remote part of the world. I wanted them to know what their father was up to when he was away from home. Of course, I saw to it that they went just before they were 12 years of age so they could go for half fare. But I noticed this, that a memory was created and a bond between us because we had had a common experience. And at least one time in their lives, I was father. And I was mother, too, in that period of absence. And I knew this, that my children learned that the whole world was their heritage. And so, such a vision of the family and of the possibility of the covenant of marriage, it seems to me, can alter sex relations and all human relations. It releases and affirms and authorizes a new and more inclusive mutuality. Women are no longer sex objects. And the fulfillment is not only within the marriage covenant, but it's possible to have this fulfillment outside of it as well. What I mean is that we've done violence by making marriage the ideal. But there are other options. The very fact that there is an option to marriage, of course, enriches both marriage and the option. And so we affirm marriage, yes, but we affirm the man and woman who by vocation gives himself or herself to art or science or teaching or the helping of all mankind. And the family extends itself to a concern for all. Now I wanted to say a word or two about the new woman and the new social vehicle. For society is to be reformulated in our time. Somebody's going to do it. There are forces waiting in the wings to engage in it, or it's just possible that we of the Christian Church will assume a large measure of responsibility for this. May I simply intrude here something which I find a little encouraging to me? We all know very well that every order of our society has come under question and under challenge in recent years. This is true of the educational order, the political order, the military establishment, the business community, the legal fraternity. There was a time when we might have supposed the medical profession would go scot-free, but no, they're under attack too, even from within their own ranks, and then of course the church. But I'd like to just to suggest to you that of all of these institutions of our society, the first one to be attacked was none other than the church, which suggests to me, I don't know what it suggests to you, that in some respects the church must have been doing its job at the sentinel position of society, where it would feel the pressures first of all. And by the same token, it seems to me it is the responsibility of the church to be there first when the reconstructive process begins. And so, with intentionality, the new woman will be engaged in creating the new world beyond her home. I mean, a little after the manner of the three masons. I've forgotten quite how it goes. One of them was earning so much money a day. Another was carving stones, and another was building a cathedral. In other words, if we have the proper intentionality, if we commit ourselves to a new family context, and that context may be an extended family such as many of you, as your very uniforms would indicate, are already a part of, if our intentionality is right, we not only serve in that context, but I repeat that we serve all mankind, all humankind. And this may be done by directly involving ourselves in the tasks of society. I have been particularly distressed when I reflect upon the fact that in the Soviet Union today, there are more women who are doctors than men. The record is rather sad in our own society. Or the very fact that 10 years ago there were more women in Congress, 17 Congresswomen and 2 senators, and today, 10 years later, only 11 Congresswomen and 1 senator. What has happened? And compare this, if you will, once again with India and Ceylon and Israel, which countries we might at times be tempted to regard as second class. And so a part of our task is to work for structures which will encourage a change of attitude toward the engagement of women in every vocation in society. I was therefore delighted to be a part of a group, 1,000 people last summer, most of them under 30, most of them laity, more than half of them women, who for a solid month under ghetto conditions worked 14 hours a day reflecting upon what the new social vehicle might be. I do not mean to say that they have come up with the answers, but at least they can start a very telling dialogue on the subject. And not only may the new woman work directly in the economy and for the reconstruction of society, but in all the dimensions of life, and be a sign to the whole world. It is of interest that humanity's question is, how long, Lord? And God's question is exactly the same, how long? So history is not closed. It is not an endless cycle. It is not static, but it is going somewhere. And our God of change invites us to change, not to freeze history, for things do not always have to be what they've always been, but to create history. And where do we start? Well, where God is at work. I was speaking a little this afternoon with the group and said that we are the community that was able to, or should be able to, identify where God is at work. For we are precisely that group that can point to the going onness in history and say that this is the going onness of God. It appears very often in secular guise. I suppose, when things were astir in Egypt many centuries ago. It must have struck Pharaoh as a rather secular event. Why all this marching about? Why all this protesting? Why not trust constitutional process? He must have seen it as a very secular happening, but not so the children of Israel, for they saw it the very work of God. Or Pontius Pilate and those gathered around him must have seen events in Jerusalem as very secular. Why all this marching around? Why all this parading into the city? Why not trust the constitutional process? It must have seemed to him that the trial and that execution was a very secular event, but not so our fathers in the faith, for they saw it as the action of God. Now, I happened to be first aware of Mahatma Gandhi when I heard of the Salt March. He started out from Sabarmati Ashram in western India, and with some 200 of his followers walked to the sea. It was about 200 miles away, and when he got there, he did a very strange thing, for he dipped an earthen pot beneath the waves, built a little fire on the beach, put the pot on that blaze, and made salt. And when he did so, he broke the law, but he also, it seemed to me, took the first solid step for the freedom of his people. For, you see, this man had political genius. What would we not give for men at this present time with the political genius that that man had? You see, that earthen pot was everybody's pot, for even the poorest family in India had a pot just like that. And not only that, but this symbolic act had a way of reaching into every home, for as no one can live without salt, so he spoke for every man. And the British had a very small tax on salt, but every single Indian had to pay that. And so by this one symbolic act, this political genius reached his hand into every life on that subcontinent, and that for good. Now, it must have been rather disturbing for the British to see all that marching around. After all, they might have trusted constitutional process. It must have seemed altogether a secular event, but not to the Indian nationalist of that day or of our own. And to some, it must have seemed that the events around Selma, Alabama, a few years ago were very secular. But to the man and woman of faith, we believe this is where God is at work. And we're the community that is supposed to identify that fact and join in with him. The issues have hardly ever been clearer: peace, social and economic justice, and plain humanity. Well, finally, the new woman relates to the new people of God. Well, all people are God's people, but the people of God are those who have called and responded to his call and are self-consciously his people. The demand is upon them. The demand is upon every one of us. Who of us can say why or how it was? I mean, say with any accuracy, why and how it was and is that we are in the faith. The fact is that we are. We are the people of God, and we are God's people, and we are the people of God. And the new woman is a spirit being because of her struggle, and will give herself to the renewing of the people of God. This afternoon, I spoke of the revolution of our time, the cultural revolution touching the political, the scientific, the urban, and the secular dimensions. While all this has been going on in the world, has the church stood still, and we are the community that knows it has not? But that God has been occupied in renewing his church at the same time as the political revolution has been storming in the world, the church has renewed itself with respect to its oneness, at the very same time as the scientific and technological revolution has been going on in the world, there has been a renewal with respect to the thought life of the church. And at the same time as the urban revolution, a liturgical renewal of all the churches. And at the same time as there's been a revolution with respect to secularity, there's been renewal of the church with respect to its ministry, attaching to all God's people. For out of the Reformation, there surely came this twofold insight that every Christian was a layman and that every Christian was a priest. And so renewal has been taking place, and this for more effective mission. And all of it is the work of God, in which women have their place. And so I found myself saying this afternoon that I thought within my lifetime the priesthood would not be denied womanhood in most of the churches, for theology doesn't have to be only a man's thing, nor the priestly vocation. Well, this brings about a new possibility then for all, and aside from women's direct service of the people of God and for the people of God, think of what a sign it would be to the world if ordination, full ordination of women were made available to them now. What a sign of renewal. What a sign of hope, not only for women, but for the poor, for those of all races, for the youth, for all. It would be a little like a realization of those words spoken in the synagogue of Nazareth a long time ago, which had to do with good news being voiced to the poor and release promised to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind. Oh, how blind we have been! And liberty to the oppressed, and proclaiming the time of the Lord's acceptance. And so awakening all social reality to the worldwide revolution in consciousness. This is what the new women would be engaged in. I've said that the human race is on trial for its life, and yet there is a kind of awakening, a stirring everywhere, all humanity crying out for its humanity in our day. I took my nephew to see last summer in New York, Beckett's Waiting for Godot. I was a little late in getting around to see it, although I had read it. And there was a great scene in it in which these two fellows, Estragon and Vladimir, carried on their constant conversation, and finally Pozzo came on scene. He was disabled and he was blind, and finally these two fellows looked at Pozzo and saw him in all his need, and he said, "He's all humanity." And then after a while they conversed and realized something about themselves, and they said, "We're all humanity." That's pretty much our situation. All humanity in the presence of all humanity calling out precisely for its humanity. And so is it not true, perhaps, that identity and responsibility finally are rolled up in one? That's the message of the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? Well, we might be under the impression that we're to look round about us to see somebody in deep human need, and that person is our neighbor. Well, that's a pretty good idea, but it's to miss the whole point of the parable. For you may remember, when Jesus came to the end of it, he said, "Which of these three proved himself to be neighbor to the man who had fallen among robbers?" In other words, we're the neighbor. That's what God intended us to be. And when we discover our identity, our responsibility is immediately evident to us. And so the church praises God for what I've called the feminine revolution and celebrates the new woman God has cast into the midst of this postmodern world. I read the other day what was thought to be a provocative statement: to be a Christian is to be a man. I have to rephrase that and say to be a Christian is to be a human being, a part of the family of God. Well, if this is to be realized in our experience, that I repeat that there are a few risks that will have to be taken. Someone said that you can't fall out of bed if you sleep on the floor, so let us launch out. Told I'm going to have to stay on the firing line here a few minutes for questions, and I'm also told that you aren't supposed to stay beyond 9:30. So if you do have any questions, I'll try my best to face them. I must have answered them all, or worn you out, the latter more likely. Oh, over here, yes.
I think I understood you to say new woman is spirit being because of her struggle. Would you follow that a little bit?
Well, I sometimes speak a little poetically, I guess, but I really mean that. I think that this is true historically. I think it's actually. I think we go for a moment over once again to the Black Revolution, which is so instructive. With respect to the other revolutions and the feminine revolution of our time, I think it may be true there that somehow the struggle was to be hammered on an anvil and made into a real implement of God. I think that is evident with respect to a good many figures in the Black Revolution. I think it is also true of a woman who has come through or is coming through the feminine revolution in our day. That's the kind of context that I have in mind. Do you want more than that?
Yes, I guess I'm too much about a different idea of spirit.
Well, I mean this a person of the spirit, if you will, a person refined, empowered by the Holy Spirit, if you will. This would be another way of putting it. Person informed by the Spirit of God and formed by the Spirit of God. This is the kind of thing I had in mind. Yes?
I'd like to ask how you think women can go about achieving solidarity. Women are afraid of the idea, I think. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm afraid I don't have any easy answers to that. There are those who would certainly spread a disunity in your ranks and would enjoy doing it. But I think that maybe doing just exactly what you are doing here, Sister Blanche Baker paid testimony to the remarkable fact that you're coming together. And she said you wouldn't forget this. I think one reason you won't forget it is you'll be doing things as a result of this, which will be, it seems to me, contributing to that solidarity, which it seems to me is important. After all, if we speak as we have of the various groups searching and seeking for humanity. Women happen to be the largest of that group. Isn't that true? Someone was, I forget exactly how it goes, but someone was trying to say recently, well, half of the women, and then, after all, more than half of the world's population, or about half the world's population is youth, that's the other half, so everybody is involved. And Aline Ford mentioned this Finland meeting. I believe that was the one in which at the first the plenary session, there was a parade of children. Is this the one where they came in with placards, and one of the placards said, never trust anyone over 12 years of age. All right. Yes, sister? I think women are focal in family by any definition, and it would seem to me this is one of the tasks to which she is immediately present, and it would seem to be a place where women could immediately dig in if they were committed to such an end as this. If they were aroused, new women, this would be a place where they might begin. And I wasn't speaking only of married women, but of others too, and particularly those who might be in the great orders, where we need the models, the wisdom, which the great corporate bodies within the church might be able to give to us in this process. The connection then is that it seems to me that this is immediately on the agenda and well within the possibility. And then, as I say, I've seen this being done, at least in a beginning way, with the prime movers being women. They spark it in many of these cases. And indeed, the aggregation, the cluster of families that I referred to, it was the women who first got the vision of this as they discussed what it meant to be a woman in our day. And one of the things that they saw immediately is they had no base to operate from unless they had some kind of a corporate structure. And where better to begin than with their own families? And how better to begin than the relating a group of families together in context of mutual support, but also a mutual mission, so that they have in their corporate structure, they have a way of getting at the problems of their community in an effective way. This is the kind of thing I have in mind. Yes, sister? I said I thought it was one of the great days in the life of the church, and I might be willing to argue that this is precisely true because our churches are not crowded, but in some sense it seems to me that the church is more really the church today than it was, say 10 years ago. These things are, of course, I suppose, relative. But there's been a sifting, and everywhere I go, I find communities of committed, intentional Christians able to give a better account of themselves than they've ever been able to give before as to why they are in the faith. They have a missional sense about them. I cited a gathering last summer of 1,000 people taking very seriously the responsibility of the church with respect to reformulation of the social order. I am well aware that numerically this is not a time of rejoicing, and that old form of triumphalism is no longer available to us. But it seems to me what has happened with respect to relationships of the Roman Catholics and the rest of us. Utterly unexpected. God took us by surprise there. I mentioned various dimensions of the renewal of the church with respect to its thought life, its liturgy, its sense of ministry belonging to the whole people of God. This awareness, these awarenesses have been so simultaneous and universal that it seems to me the man and woman of faith must see this as the work of God in our midst. That's the kind of thing that I would try to flesh out, the rather bald statement that I made at the beginning, and fearful that I wouldn't have another context in which I could say that. Yes, sister, at the back. Well, I'm fairly familiar with the church in India, and it seems to me, by and large, the church as I know it in India is a little better equipped with respect to trained and able and committed women than it is with respect to male leadership at the present time. Just again and again, as you travel around that subcontinent, you are confronted with signal figures in the person of women, and you're simply astounded by their training, their dedication, very often their charismatic quality. I mentioned Mother Teresa in Calcutta, and the kind of women she has been able to gather around her. I might mention the kind of spontaneous availability, people making themselves available spontaneously from the churches all over the subcontinent to serve in the refugee camps, some 2,000 such camps of varying sizes. I was in one of them, 280,000 people there. But there was a kind of an infiltration of students from the student Christian movement. There were doctors, nurses, teachers, for example, from the various churches all over India who had come there to serve in this situation. It was a great thing to see the Anglican, or what was the Anglican Cathedral, it's now the Church of North India Cathedral in Calcutta, which was being used largely as a warehouse for supplies to be forwarded to these situations. I can't think of a better way to use at least a good part of a cathedral in these days in the proximity to that kind of human need is found there. Well, I was encouraged by what I saw there. And the fact that Christians moving from the villages relate themselves in great numbers to the church in the city. I mentioned this afternoon how they were torn away from their roots in this transition, but they are able to find roots again very often, that is, those who are Christians in the churches of the city, and this gives me encouragement. These are not days when one talks a little or very much about growth in the church, but a modest but rather steady growth there. And although those of us in this country often cite the matter of growth as a kind of an index, we mustn't allow ourselves to be too provincial in this respect. This may be true in this country, but in Indonesia, the church today is growing very rapidly in a numerical sense. Likewise in Brazil, of course there are other problems one must speak of when he talks about Brazil. Likewise, in Africa, so that at the present rate, half of the population of Africa by the year 2000 would be Christian, and we would be confronted by that time with the astonishing fact that the non-Western world would be outnumbered by Christians in another part of the world, which all makes it very interesting. Yes?
Oh,
well, of course, that's another ball game. There are sannyasis, as they're called, one of the names in the Hindu in Hinduism, and they have sannyasins. Are you referring to the nun in the non-Christian context? They do. I've never been able to be turned on much by the so-called holy men of India because, well, there's plenty of evidence that they're very often, well, not too prepossessing, shall we say. And it's sort of stretching terminology to call them holy. But then that's a... once again, here is another big realm that perhaps one ought to be on that theme more directly to, in order not to distort it excessively. Well, oh yes. Well, first of all, if I have been understood as being speaking in an individual sense, I've certainly been misunderstood. This has not been my intention at all, but throughout to imply a corporate structure. It's true that I spoke of the new woman, but I meant her multiplied many times over and always involved in a corporate context of one type or another. A church, an ecclesiola, an extended family, an intentional group of some sort. Oh, well, if I understand you, I couldn't agree more that that this must be done in a corporate way to be effective. And when I spoke of the new social vehicle and social responsibility, that's what I meant to be central to what I was saying. I guess I didn't make it clear. But it would seem to me that that here we're called upon not simply to exude goodwill, but to do plotting and planning, as it were, together of our mission. It's been my endeavor to encourage this constantly in the part of the church with which I have responsibility, so that, for example, every one of the of our congregations is in Maine, in the state of Maine, every one of them now, it has been placed in what we call a cooperative parish of some 10 congregations working together to as a larger unit to give its corporate witness and to become change agents in that part of the country. I would think that the old equation of one pastor, one congregation is no longer appropriate, but it must be a grouping of congregations in order to make this effective. I sometimes think that the enemies of the gospel would rejoice if they had anything like what one might call the apparatus that we have as Christians, even in the denomination of which I am a part. We have 41,000 local congregations across this country. I say that the United Methodist Church is more present in our society than any other American institution, with the possible exception of the post office. And yet, I say the enemies of the gospel would rejoice if they had such a foundation, or take the 200,000, perhaps, congregations we have in this country, but we are not using that corporate energy. We haven't learned to use it effectively, one might almost say at all in this regard, so that we can... but here it's there to be used. Your point's well taken. Well, I think I was supposed to stop at 9:30, and according to my time, it is 9:30. I've enjoyed a lot being here.